What are you, about a size 14? Welcome, and we're back to another episode of Mike, Mike, and Oscar. Another retrospective. We just can't stop doing them now. We got the taste back in our mouth, so we're diving right back in. Going to be talking about the 1991-92 Best Leading Actress category today. Couple heavy hitters, only four films, but five nominations. The nominees for this one, Jodie Foster for Silence of the Lambs, who ended up winning the category, Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon for their roles as Thelma and Louise, Laura Dern in Rambling Rose, and Bette Midler in For the Boys. This episode, this part one, we're only going to be talking about the first two movies, Silence of the Lambs for Jodie Foster, Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon's performance in Thelma and Louise. As well, you will get the year in review, which you probably are just going to want to skip because it's just awful. It's really depressing and really sad for some reason.
Look at you, though. Look at this intro. Serious and
I haven't even gotten our names. I know. I am the co-host, Mike One. This is my co-host, also Mike.
I am also Mike. I'm very impressed with you.
I actually tried to prepare for once. I figured after 70-some-odd episode, do things a little
differently. Yeah, but you didn't blink or look down that entire intro.
I have an inhale. I have a heart problem. But this is what we're doing, the Best Leading Actress category of 91-92. Talking about the 64th Academy Awards. They were held March 30th, 1992. Guess where, Mike?
In South Dakota.
Yeah, that's right. The Dorothy Chandler Pavilion in L.A., as they seem to have all been, except for the last couple of years, hosted by Billy Crystal, as often did as well. Just to give you a little preview of what was going on the night of, Bugsy was the most nominated film for that night with 10 nominations. Silence of the Lambs was both the leader in terms of awards won, five, but also only the third and most recent film, the last time it's happened to date, that a movie swept the quote-unquote big five categories on the night, those categories being the wins for Best Picture, Best Director, both lead acting category wins, and of course a screenplay. It did win Best Adapted Screenplay as well.
I did want to bring up this movie that won the big five categories. Mm-hmm. Came out January 30th, platformed all the way up to Valentine's Day, where it kind of went wide. That's an early release that reminds us of this past year.
Yeah, we talked about it during Get Out. The last horror movie came out, I think, in February. Don't quote me on this. I should have looked it up. I didn't have time to. But I think it's also the last February release that was nominated for a Best Picture as well. Also a horror movie. Also came out early in the year, like you said. So very interesting parallels to what's going on. And also a lot of parallels to the feministic movement that we've dealt with in the last couple of years with these films. That's kind of why we did it. We wanted to have a little retrospective of as to what the leading ladies and the feminist tones in those movies had been some 20-some-odd years ago compared to what we're going through today.
This first episode will encapsulate those arguments beautifully and cinematically. The next episode, just tune in for that one because we're going to have some serious rage for how they fail and stumble over it. But performance is all five of them really have, there's something to say about it. So I'm looking forward to this.
That's big of you to say and give Rambling Rose that credit, that Laura Dern's performance.
Well, Laura Dern's always good. It's just that movie, it was written by Thomas Shulman. Not Thomas Shulman. Thomas Shulman's pen name.
Right, sure.
Listen to our Dead Poets Society review. Mike, we had some fire.
Mike is on a bit of a streak here, just saying some terrible things about some of these pen screenwriters and rightfully
I'm
so.
Having some rage. Rightfully I'm so. Having yeah. some rage. I'm getting after
it's
some
not
people.
Like you're doing it unnecessarily. Well, we don't like tearing people down on this podcast.
Look, we're more appreciation than we are criticism. But when we do go for the jugular,
it's warranted.
We like to think so.
It's warranted, certainly. So let's talk about the year in review of 1991-92. Do you have any loved ones that are like near their deathbeds? Because you're going to want to not be near them for this.
My butt is clenched.
Yeah, all right. Here we go. We'll start off appropriately enough in January of 1991. And I have some very sad news for this month. I don't know why it all happened at one time, but here we go. The nation's first anti-stalking law goes into effect in the state of California, so When Harry Met Sally got in just under the deadline, apparently, from the 1989 Best Original Screenplay episode we did.
It's a little harsh.
No, it's not. Go back to that episode. I lose it over when Harry... As mad as Mike is over Thomas Shulman, I am equally as enraged about When Harry Met Sally.
He made some good points. It's good stuff.
Congress authorizes the use of military force to expel Iraqi troops from Kuwait, and the Gulf War Operation Desert Storm would officially begin soon after. January of 91 again, Eileen Wuornos confesses to the serial murder of six men, which would go on to win Charlize Theron her Academy Award for the portrayal of the killer over a decade later on film.
Hell of a movie.
Just to prove it wasn't all doom and gloom in January of 91, Nelson Mandela negotiated peace talks between two warring South African political parties whose relationship had devolved into frequent violence.
Diplomacy.
We survived January of 91. We're out. Those were a couple sad stories.
By real heroes and non-diplomacy by others.
And podcasts by real heroes, right? We can talk about that.
Sure. Yeah, we're on that level.
February of 91 saw a ceasefire and a declared victory of the Gulf
Same
War
thing.
By President George H.W. Bush. March, the good times are short-lived as the infamous Rodney King beating is caught on tape where a black civilian was brutally attacked by numerous LAPD officers, which would then lead to an infamous trial and inevitably the famous L.A. riots.
God damn it.
U.S. and Albania resumed diplomatic relations for the first time in over 50 years in March as well.
Okay, give me more of that, please.
Brings us into April. Look... Again, I could tell you about the 138,000 plus people killed by a cyclone in Bangladesh, or I could tell you about the 7.0 magnitude earthquake which killed 239 people in the country of Georgia, or I could tell you about how Pennsylvania Senator John Hines was killed in a helicopter crash, but this has been negative enough so far, so I'm going to focus on the positive, and instead I'll tell you about Comedy Central made its debut as a cable station this month.
Thank God.
Yay.
And did Dennis Miller have his own show?
Is that, probably, yeah.
Or was that the therapist stay. Show? What was the
Dr.
one?
Dr. Katz there?
Dr. Katz?
Yeah.
Just all stand-up comedy?
Yeah. May had the first Starbucks open, so our addiction was fed from that point on. Uh-huh. July 22nd was a big day for some awful reasons, unfortunately.
Those all seem like coping mechanisms, by the way. Comedy Central.
They are.
Caffeine.
There's no other explanation. It was a dark year for news.
Oh, good God.
July 22nd specifically, big day for some awful reasons. First, Mike Tyson was arrested and charged with the rape of Desiree Washington, which would eventually lead to his conviction and prison sentence right in the middle of the prime of his meteoric boxing career.
Ugh.
A very famous, infamous case there. And if that didn't bum you out enough, this was also happened to be the same day that police officers found the human remains of up to 11 people in the apartment of Jeffrey Dahmer.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Big July 22nd. Happy anniversary coming up for America. And terrible.
Ugh.
August. Happy news. Super Nintendo was released. And Mike 1 and his brother Schmave's lives were forever changed from that point forward. October would also go on to change the lives of America as Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton announced his intention to run for president in the 1992 presidential election. Clarence Thomas also confirmed into the U.S. Supreme Court in that month. So we're okay. We've survived the darkness that July and previous brought, and we're coming out of it. And December is even happier news, as the Soviet Union, which had been slowly crumbling for months, officially ended, as Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus leaders agreed to dissolve the Union and form the Commonwealth of Independent States, which would later lead to Gorbachev resigning as Soviet Union president, because it's tough to be president when the thing you're president of has chosen to dissolve.
Good point.
Thank you. I'm here for the facts only. January of 92, the final vestiges of the Cold War are puttering out as Boris Yeltsin and George H.W. Bush both declared that they will cease targeting the other and their allies with nuclear weapons, and an official announcement regarding the end of the Cold War, the official end of the Cold War after decades and decades of tensions between the U.S. and Russia, would officially be announced February 1st, 1992. So we started with the dark, we ended up a little bit happier at the end there, but yeah, rough times certainly that these movies were seen against, the backdrop of which all these films were seen in their day.
These films, I'll be honest with you, kind of reflect some of
the
that
times,
disillusionment, and none more so than Silence of the Lambs, which, as screenwriting gurus have talked about, is perhaps the foremost thriller of the decade, if not the century.
Yeah, its creep factor definitely still holds up, if nothing else, which I'm sure we're going to say more positive things about it, but at the minimum, you could say it's still a legitimately terrifying movie.
Made Jonathan Demme's career, and from the novel all the way through the screenplay to what was on screen there, this one has been dissected as perhaps the movie, the story I've studied the most throughout my life as a
really
amateur screenwriter. The guys, want to give one shout out, the guys at the Story Grid do a terrific job. If you're looking for an analysis of this story, and you know, the Thomas Harris book, Ted Talley's script, they really stick close to one another.
Cool.
So I love their analysis of it. Go seek them out. They're a great podcast and a great website and all that too.
Definitely something I'll be looking up in the near future, having just finished this movie once again for probably, conservatively, the 51st, 52nd watching in my life. But that's where we're going to start. That'll be the first nominee Best Leading Actress category. Jodie Foster playing Clarice Starling for her role in The Silence of the Lambs. And as he always does in a great way every retrospective episode, also Mike is going to get us started with a production production profile.
Jodie Foster, biofilmography. Born in L.A. to wealthy parents and descendants of the Mayflower. Jodie's father was a decorated Air Force pilot and made his living as a real estate broker, and her mom was a Hollywood publicist. Perfect genes, perhaps.
Born in the industry,
yeah. A salesman father, she's got to sell the lines, and a publicist mom, she's got to navigate the cesspool that is Hollywood.
And then if Jodie Foster actually hated her parents, she's listening to this right now, just screaming at the podcast, you know nothing about me!
The true meaning of...
Hi, Jodie, by the way, you're definitely listening.
She's awesome. The true meaning of an acting prodigy, Foster began her career in show business at 3 years of age in TV ads as the Coppertone Girl, and on the sitcom Mayberry RFD. By 7, she had recurring acting roles on Mayberry and The Courtship of Eddie's Father. TV movies, mostly for Disney, and a few more renowned TV series would follow, including Bonanza, My Three Sons, and The Addams Family, as well as TV series versions of films, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, and Paper Moon. Remember when they made, you know, based TV shows on middling hit movies, Mike? How come they don't do that anymore?
I remember when they had TV shows that rolled.
It's a joke. They still do that.
Well, I was going to say, I remember when they had, TV shows as movies, but they don't do TV shows that turn into movies anymore. Rarely. Which is, they did that back in the day.
Right. No, this is definitely the opposite.
The opposite is definitely come back in a big way. Yeah, you're
absolutely
right.
Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, that needed to be made into a TV show.
Yeah, stomping on your joke there. Gulliver's traveling your joke.
You were ponderous. Okay. Well, they got a reaction out of you, so I'm okay. At 12 years old, Foster nabbed a role in Martin Scorsese's Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which would ultimately convince Scorsese to cast her 2 years later in Taxi Driver, where she would be nominated for her first Oscar as a 14-year-old kid.
You play a great prostitute. Here's an Academy Award nomination.
So she's basically a genius.
You play a great prostitute, child.
Yeah, the movie's a good movie, but it's a little scary there. Yeah. She's basically a genius, though, Jodie Foster. Definitely a prodigy, like I said. So she was sent, of course, to a French language speaking prep school in LA, all the while acting in movies throughout the 70s and becoming a teenage movie star. Highlights include the original Freaky Friday, Bugsy Malone, and The Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane. She actually became the youngest person to ever host Saturday Night Live in 1976.
How about that for a nugget?
So Wikipedia talks a lot about her transition to adult roles, but as we both just said, she played a whore in Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. What makes her more adult than that?
She got her driver's license. 14 than we are right now.
Oh my God. Anyway, after 12 more years of movie acting, a short break there to finish high school and some passing fancy she called graduating from Yale University, Jodie's breakout role as an adult came at the age of 26, 1988, The Accused. Apparently, get this, Foster was initially very upset with her own performance in The Accused. Yeah. She didn't even want to rewatch it. She was really down on herself. But the Academy, the Hollywood Foreign Press, the British Academy, the BAFTAs, and the National Board of Review all disagreed with her as they gave her an Oscar, a BAFTA, a Globe for that performance and a National Board of Review Award.
Great inner conflict in her.
3 years later, Foster was cast as Clarice Starling in The Silence of the Lambs. Foster, she's had a remarkable career as a writer, director, and of course as an actress. Since then, a couple of my favorites, Panic Room, Flight Plan, I thought she was great in that, even though the movie's okay. Inside Man, she's awesome. The Brave One, she's better than the movie, but it's pretty solid. And I just love her in Carnage. It's a play. It's like a, really fun. Those are some of my recent favorites. She was also nominated for a fourth Oscar in Nell and won the Cecil B. DeMille Award at the 2013 Golden Globes. Her writing directing career includes episodes of House of Cards and Black Mirror, this recent season 4, and feature films The Beaver and Money Monster. She was also nominated for an Emmy for her direction of an episode of Orange is the New Black.
Yeah, we're talking about, people don't realize it when you think of Jodie Foster, but she is a pillar of Hollywood. Somebody literally born in the industry, been in the industry since she was 3 years old, you said.
Conquering every aspect of it.
And remember when we had people growing up in the industry that didn't make front page tabloid news or lose their minds or go on a coke binge out in the clubs every weekend or day?
Yeah, she's just, her career is steadily moving forward. And she's always had high standards for the most part. And even their big box office blockbuster type movies have been very ambitious. Say what you want about Contact, it didn't work. Very ambitious.
Yeah, oh, no question movie. About the ambition. Yeah, ambition.
So, yeah, she's always had some high standards there. So
Payoff was a little issue on that one, but that's a different subject for a different Payoff? Day. And Contact.
Oh, correct. Yeah, yeah. Yes, sir. Yes, yes. The payoff problem, yes. I would say, yes.
Not her fault.
No.
So we'll talk about Jodie Foster in Silence of the Lambs, some specs of the film. She does play Clarice Starling. Obviously, everybody knows that by now. Film debuted, also Mike told you earlier, January 30th, 1991 in New York City. Went wide on Valentine's Day, so a nice way to spend your date with your loved one. Eating some...
Counter-programming, man. Some liver. They've been doing it for a while.
Fava beans and a nice Chianti. Jonathan Demme is the director, written by Ted Talley. The screenplay, it was based on Thomas Harris's novel. Stated in the intro, it won 5 Oscars on the evening, but actually had 2 other nominations it didn't win. Best Film Editing, where it lost to JFK, the Oliver Stone movie, and Best Sound, where it lost to Terminator 2. Probably the right call in both of those.
Yeah,
it did win that sweep of the Big 5, though. Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Director, Best Lead Actor for Hopkins. Still the record holder, by the way, for the lead actor winner with the shortest amount of screen time in his movie. And Best Picture, and the reason that we're here, Jodie Foster winning Best Lead Actress as well. A 118-minute runtime produced by Strong Heart and Demi Productions and distributed by Orion Pictures. It is well-received and reviewed. 8.6 IMDb rating. All the more impressive when you consider it has over 1 million ratings from users, putting it at number 24 in the IMDb top 250.
That's crazy.
Actually tied for number 18 with the likes of Star Wars Episode
4. We are number nerds, especially with those IMDb stuff. My goodness.
Don't
million.
Don't live by the tomato meter.
Like 600,000 might be the biggest number I've seen.
Yeah, million. Over 1 million. Well wow. Over 1 million, too.
Wow.
Up there, tied along the likes of Star Wars Episode 4, Kurosawa's Seven Samurai, and 2 movies that some argue are derivative works of Dr. Lecter and companies later on in the 90s, Seven and The Usual Suspects.
I had a friend who watched Seven Samurai with me back. He was a medical student, and I'm there jerking off as a film guy in my dorm room. My roommate, medical student, watched Seven Samurai with me, and in the middle of the movie, he just like, screamed in the air. It's like, what are we watching? And for the next 2 years, I think we were sophomores at the time. For the next 2 years, he was like, "You want to watch Seven Samurai?" It was like an inside joke.
So it wasn't his cup of tea.
All recorded.
Akira Kurosawa, listen, not his favorite film.
Seven
filmmaker.
Samurai has its moments, and it's worth its while, but you have to, another movie you have to be up for. It's a long movie too.
Silence of the Lambs carries a 95% certified fresh Rotten Tomatoes score on 86 critic scores, 82 of them being positive, an average critic score of 8.7 out of 10, a 95% audience score on 845,000 reviews, average of 4.1 out of 5, and it also carries with it an 85 Meta rating. It was made for a listed budget of $19 million and ended up with a worldwide box office gross of $272.4 million.
Okay, so hopefully you've had some fun with us so far. We are going to kind of give you premise information, I guess, as we review these performances. That means stuff in the trailers, stuff going into early part of Act 2. So if you haven't heard a retrospective for us on a Best Acting category, that's where we'll head with it. We're not going to give third act spoilers. We're going to try really hard not to give even late Act 2 spoilers. But we may discuss the performances in those parts of the movie. So just a heads up.
Yeah, we usually do full spoilers for the movie-centric categories, Best Picture, Best Original or Adapted Screenplay, etc. When it comes to the acting, we certainly try to focus more on the performances and keep the big twists and turns of the plot up to you. We want to motivate you to see these performances and see the movies themselves. That's the whole crisis.
Absolutely.
The whole crux, I should say. Now,
however,
that said...
next episode, we're going to go full spoilers because we don't want you to see those two movies. And we want to talk shit about those two not performances, but to those two stories.
Right, the performances, not terrible. The movies.
So, Thelma and Louise, however, and Silence of the Lambs, however notorious they are, we're going to try to just focus on what needs to be focused.
Right. So, that said, Silence of the Lambs obviously is a picture focusing on new FBI trainee, not yet formally assigned to a division, Clarice Starling, given the assignment to go talk to Dr. Hannibal Lecter in the hopes, which is really that she can find information about the notorious serial killer on the loose that the FBI is currently hunting, Buffalo Bill, only she doesn't know that at first and is wise to the game later on in the movie.
That's the premise, man, right from the third scene of the movie.
Giving it right away.
Just bang, 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 three scenes, and we got one of the most terrifying act one climaxes, showdowns that we've ever seen.
And think about those three scenes to start. One, you're given like overhead shots. The second one is basically her in training in the FBI camp, and then she's put on assignment. And in those three scenes alone, you're given this is a capable protagonist, both physically, mentally, she's accomplished, educationally wise.
That credits montage is so cinematic. It's not, you don't have to get the battle of the sexes talk about feminism. You don't have to get the quote unquote stronger together speech as we like those.
I say even more than
it's
that.
It's not cinematic.
It doesn't.
All she has to do is walk on an elevator, and now you know her full story and what she's made of and her metal. It's great.
And it's kind of ahead of its time, too, in terms of it's not, you're right, it's not an beating you over the head feminist empowerment story, but at the same time, it doesn't matter what gender this protagonist is.
But they show it. They don't have to literally speak it to you. Thelma Louise accomplishes a lot of those same things, too. But I just love the fact that so early on, Starling is that audience surrogate. The camera is close up on her face.
Oh, the camera work in this is great.
It's so phenomenal. Like cinematography, I know it's very basic. Yeah. I know they're going for grittiness. They're going for drabness. Because like I said, she's walking into the seventh circle of hell where they keep these serial killers. And that camera, that whatever that shot is, we've looked this up before and since forgotten that, it's not a tracking shot, but the camera backs up while the lens zooms in, and then she's walking. They do it a couple times in the movie, and when she's walking down the hallway, we're getting her reacting to each one of these prisoners on the left of her, and of course when she squares off with Hannibal Lecter. So that's basically the premise. It's electric.
Everything. There's so many little things done in this movie, too, that because when she's walking down the corridor where all these madmen are held, it's dark and dingy and damp, and she's hearing voices from these cells, and because it's such an empty space, they echo off, so the mood setting is really, really well done as well.
The setup is terrific. She's shown pictures of what Hannibal's done to people.
Who is a cannibal, for those of you who don't know. That's also explained right off the top. Right. Hannibal Lecter is this notorious bad guy in film, and he is a cannibal that eats his prey.
So it's amazing, and you're scared for her, you're scared of what she's going to have to see. It's so effective in terms of being cinematic there, never mind the storytelling. So now we get to that showdown, and Mike, I want to put this on the level, the scenes between Lecter and Clarice throughout the movie, I put them up with Daniel Day-Lewis and Leslie Manville from Phantom Thread. I put them up with Pacino and Cazale from Godfather 2, up with Meryl Streep and Philip Seymour Hoffman from Doubt, some of the best acting showdowns in history, in my opinion, certainly ranking up there in the history of our podcast. I loved it.
Can't argue with any of that. I mean, it's some of my favorite scenes in the movie. It's some of my favorite scenes of all time. It's this tete-a-tete chess game between two obviously highly intelligent people, one of which is chaotic good and one of which is chaotic evil, and they're just going at it.
Oh, and that's what the chaotic good and evil thing means.
I don't know. I just keep saying it, hoping that I'll hit something one day.
It's remarkable. What is said is so poignant.
Well, I guess she'd be lawful good because she's literally of the law. So
right.
It's the diagonal on the pyramid.
But think about what the script matrix. Yeah, think about what the script is doing. You have to get through such detailed, vivid, grotesque information, right? The exposition is weaponized throughout these scenes about Buffalo Bill and the serial murderer on the fringe.
How rare is that, by the way? Not to get you off track, but you have this serial killer that's on the loose that the FBI is actively hunting, and he's like the third wheel to anything going on.
It's like, well, yeah. And it's amazing because it's all getting towards that point, and yet you have this both this dialogue of manners and one of the more higher stakes in any meeting with the mentor you will ever see on screen in that early act one, which is typically what you get for a hero character, a hero cop. She's got to meet with her mentor, right?
Yeah.
She's got to meet with...
Except that her mentor, in this case, for all intents and purposes, isn't the FBI agent that they set it up to be, because he does take a shine to her, the FBI captain or lieutenant or whatever you want to call him there.
But a census taker once tried tried to test me. I mean,
her mentor is this deranged serial killer that wants, and you can tell this throughout the movie, Lecter wants Clarice to get in his head for her purposes. Like, he wants to make her the best agent possible.
Remarkable how both her character and the script tries to humanize the character of Hannibal Lecter when everybody calls him a monster, when everything he does is monstrous, when
the manipulation of the script is amazing. You're rooting for a guy that eats people.
My screenwriting professor back in college always used to say, guys, if you show a capable character, no matter what that capability is, if it's good or for evil, your audience is going to be fascinated when you show a level of that level of capability. So you're going to admire Hannibal Lecter no matter what. Oh. Because he just what he's able to do, and with the... Is panache a word?
Yeah, it is. Good for you.
Panache. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, you got it, man. You have a little confidence.
I don't trust you.
I say every word hoping that it means
but
something.
Hannibal's got all these quips, right? He's got all these personality tropes that he's developed.
He definitely has a motif that he's kind of brought to the table.
He's got such a flair for the dramatic.
It precedes himself,
right?
Yeah.
You give him that, as well as his, you know, extreme evil and the capability. Oh my God, it's one of the more fascinating characters ever. It's like the devil in Genesis.
And that's why he's such a beloved character in cinematic history. But it wouldn't be nearly that way if it wasn't for Clarice Starling. And if it wasn't
and
for Jodie Foster.
Because she stands up to him.
Exactly. Right away, too. One of the first things she says when she's ready to leave her first confrontation with Hannibal Lecter is, yeah, take all that psychoanalysis babble bullshit that you just put on me, and why don't you put it on yourself, you crazy fuck, and see what you like, because I bet you won't like The View. Immediately, right away, she's challenging him.
She will take his best punches throughout this screenplay, but also not just basically, if you write Hannibal off in any of these movies, in the whole series, if you write him off as a monster, then basically he's like, okay, I'm a monster, you're dead.
Yeah, right? Exactly. She wants to play the game. One, because she knows it'll help her, which is to your point, and two, because she legitimately thinks she has a chance to win.
And what I just thought was so phenomenal is you see her working through all this on her facial expressions, what she's trying
her
to
face
repress.
In this movie. You brought it up.
She's trying to repress the repulsion she feels for this guy, for what he's saying. And he knows he's pushing her buttons, right?
She's at his mercy at times, too, having to tell her life story at times that she doesn't want to.
The look of sheer abject terror that she is just fighting with and wrestling with throughout those scenes, with a flick of her eyelashes, with a look down, and just you could feel the sinking feeling going through her just based on what she's doing there. It's amazing.
We mentioned Jodie Foster won this category at the top. She did take home the Oscar for Best Leading Actress. It was well-deserved, but I think the idea, not only that Clarice Starling is such a well-known name still in pop culture lore, the idea that this movie did come out so early, the studio probably didn't think it was an Oscar contender. They thought most likely it'd be a niche picture because it is overly grotesque, especially for the early 90s, for a film that's a thriller and not a slasher. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really a testament to both lead performances, what they were able to get out of this picture and toe that line between the overly grotesque and too much when you're dealing with subject matter that is just awful.
Right.
And making it a procedural, a crime procedural, which it is for by and large.
If they went full horror movie with it, it would have been something that fell...
It would have suffered.
On its face.
It would have suffered.
Like Psycho
did,
right? Yep. Like a lot of other movies in the past. But just like Get Out shifted genre, this movie went to the thriller genre and I think earned respect of a lot of the writers in Hollywood at the time by going that way.
Totally.
And this movie is very, it really plays with genre. So I love what Jonathan Demme's take on it was, that direct style. But at the same time, these performances just elevate
things.
Doesn't
happen without Foster. And Foster's really the centerpiece of it all, because like we said, Hopkins isn't on screen for all that long, and the camera is focused on Foster for the most part. So we've gushed over and over again about this movie and about the performances and the lead performances, Foster specifically, but let's officially put it in writing now. What is we do best and worst scenes for these retrospectives? Let's start with best scenes featuring Jodie Foster, hopefully.
Can I say the whole movie? Well, listen, I mean, the Hannibal Starling scenes are electric. Each one of those is a masterclass in acting, and you can pick any one of those as your quote-unquote favorite.
Totally agree.
I just want to use these best scene segment to kind of also mention the action scenes. For my money, there are a few sequences better than the finale of this film in terms of what thrillers have to offer. I love the finale. I love the innovation of it. I love where it goes. To say it's full of twists and turns would not be spoiling. It's just saying Star Wars has war in the stars.
In space. Yeah.
How she interacts with Crawford, how she charms the bug guys, how she interacts with all the men in this movie is also a strong of a feminist statement that we've seen in movies to date, in any of the movies that we've studied. And I did want to make a great shout out to Thomas Harris and also to Clarice Starling's Jodie Foster for pulling that off, because it's as powerful a feminist statement as we've seen.
Yeah, you brought up a point that I wanted to make, that scene where she's dealing with the body and it's a room full of all police men. There's very few women in the room, and she's the one that speaks up and says, "You guys did all you can for her, but we need the room cleared."
Yeah.
And they all listen to her because they know she's no bullshit and all business and there to do a job.
And that's after her boss called her out in that same scenario a while back. I mean, she could have just
clammed up. Awesome and great character evolution too throughout those scenes. You hit the nail on the head as well. The Foster Hopkins scenes and the action scenes too, there are iconic images that are a result of the action scene. When Hannibal is held down in Tennessee after Jodie Foster comes to visit him, the what happens from there on out leads to one of the most iconic scenes. I mean, it's awesome.
It's hard to remember because we've watched this movie so many times, but I just think back to this movie and how glued we were to the screen the first few times you saw it, and how out of breath you were after coming out of the Hannibal Clarice scenes, anything with Hannibal on the screen, never mind. But of course, as we are surrogates through her, through our protagonist of the story, I don't remember feeling that way for other movies. It's very rare that happens.
And that's what we said about in our Filmly Feud episode, as you hear my dog in the background, what we said about Lord of the Rings, how there's certain movies that you know are game changers. Right. And that's a credit to why Hannibal Lecter and Clarice Starling, when you say those names, people know immediately who you're talking about today. They ring true because of these performances.
They hit some fundamentals, though, cinematic fundamentals. And Aaron Sorkin has done this, and Hitchcock, of course. When you write a dialogue scene as some of the
juicy,
most ruthless combat. We just saw it in Phantom Threat. There's ruthless psychological warfare between those characters going on. Same way as the cat and mouse game of The Godfather 2 between brother and brother.
Yeah.
Right? When you have that ammunition to work with, it's phenomenal. So the story is great, and of course these characters pull it off.
That said, I do have some gripes, and again, with a movie this fantastic.
How? What? I'm going to turn into Little John here. What?
The movie, this great. They're probably just nitpicks more than anything, because it's tough to have huge gripes with something like this. But I have a couple. I'm sorry. Do you?
I have none. No.
Oh, really? Okay.
There are no worse scenes in my book.
First of all, the worst is how I feel when I watch Monk now, because Ted Levine is the captain in that movie. And
golf clap. That's good.
Second is, so Clarice is a trainee, right?
Trainee, but she's pretty far along.
Yeah, she's in the FBI, but she hasn't been assigned anywhere yet. She hasn't.
Well, but she's pretty far along in her training.
Right, but she's a student still, basically.
Yeah, but we see her doing involved training exercises.
Right. Okay.
So she's not like a totally green.
But they're going to send someone that's still taking classes to go interview one of the most ruthless, notorious, psychologically manipulative serial killers of all time by herself.
Out of sheer desperation from Crawford's point of view. I mean, this is his last card to play. I mean, this is his ultimate game with Hannibal. Like, because all the best therapists, all the best doctors, all the best FBI goons have not been able to crack this guy, have not been able to make anything he says useful. Well, all the greatest psychological tools in terms of the most, those powers of perception, like you said, all those questionnaires and whatever mind games you try to play with this guy, he will completely turn it against you. So what can he do? He's just going to send a street smart kid who's going to be honest with this guy and maybe open up some kind of humanity out of him and bring something out of him, some paternal instinct. That's what's so genius about this.
You know, I think you talked me out of it. I think you explained that away. The issue for me was that
I blacked out. What happened?
You don't get that sense of Crawford's at his wit's end with it. At least I didn't. I usually write the character's name and then who plays them in parentheses.
Scott Glenn.
Yeah. I have Jack Crawford in parentheses. I have Jack Crawford. So I have Jack Crawford playing Jack Crawford as played by Jack Crawford. Well, I'm an idiot, is what I'm saying.
I may have listened to this book once or twice, too. So I just, and watched the TV show and seen the movie 1,000 times and all of it. So I kind of know Crawford fairly well. And yeah,
and JC go way back.
Yeah.
Not Jesus Christ. But. I think you're talking about that was the biggest linchpin of
what else?
Give anger I had. The only other negative or pseudo negative I guess I have is that, okay, you're playing this big cat and mouse game with Hannibal and the authorities and the doctor of the psych ward and etc. A deal is struck. Hannibal is to be transferred if he gives up some piece of information. Okay.
Yeah.
He's put in front of the proper authorities to give that information.
Because he negotiates that, yeah.
Right. They act immediately on his transfer as soon as he gives up the name without checking anything. Which leads to a big... It's tough to do without giving full spoilers.
I mean, they're going to corroborate his information.
But they clearly don't.
No, they do. They're throughout there. And Crawford talks about it. All the research that he did based on what Starling got out of him and what he told them all about his files and about what the physical description of the guy. So they corroborated all fits at the end.
Okay.
I mean, what's really cool about this
story. Right. No, but...
Because you get a little bit here, a little bit there, right, and it actually comes together, and she's got to figure it
what
out.
What fooled me is, if you watch the movie and you have any idea what I'm talking about, you'll see why I was fooled by that.
I'm pretty sure we've talked about this before. I would say the one negative in terms of timing and in terms of how this script and how this story has been kind of misinterpreted or, you know, genuinely interpreted in a way that people have taken offense to it is it doesn't do a lot to help a certain sect of our population that have been oppressed for many years. I don't want to give away spoilers, but it doesn't help the cause of trans people in our world at this time period. Even though they talk it away as not being indicative, this character not being indicative of trans people, in terms of the zeitgeist and people's perceptions, this was a tough pill to swallow for that community. So
yeah, it's like one genuine step forward for femininity and one kind of sidestep at best or step backwards for the LGBTQ community.
And Harris does a lot to explain it away that obviously the script does, and Clarice talks about it in her understanding way. So the fact
that that's why I said sidestep. There is some understanding, but you're right. Overall, it's presented pretty much with a
you can misinterpret this to be against that community, or at least use it as ammunition to go against that community, which is sad.
So this is a don't watch for you.
No, it's one of the best stories told in the last two decades. So take that for what you will.
Yeah, I totally agree. There's a reason that that's so well known and loved still to this day. So that's Jodie Foster as Clarice Starling. We'll move on to the next movie, which has two Academy Award nominees. Only the fifth time in cinematic history that two women have been nominated for the best leading actress in the same film, and it is also the last time that such an event has happened.
Wow.
We're talking, of course, about the movie Thelma and Louise, where Gina Davis plays Thelma and Susan Sarandon plays Louise. In Thelma and Louise, I'll give you some specs to start off. Directed by Ridley Scott, which was not a fact I knew prior to watching it, but there you go. Written by Callie Corey in her first credited screenplay ever, and one of only three in terms of feature-length films written by her, the other two being the Julia Roberts-Dennis Quaid 1995 film Something to Talk About, and the 2002 much-joked-about film The Divine Secrets of the Ya-Ya Sisterhood.
Still, though, how does that not become a great career?
I don't
know. Shepherded, not...
Yeah.
Not built up, not developed.
She didn't have many writing credits overall. Only a couple TV shows.
It's sad because the female writers just weren't developed the same way.
It's nice to see female empowerment was a running theme throughout whatever she did put pen to paper. As a means of review, we have the writer of the Ya-Ya Sisterhood penning a script to be directed by the guy that did Alien and Gladiator. So that's a nice combination.
It's amazing that she sold a script to be directed by that guy because that guy directs certain kind of movies. And yeah, I mean, that's amazing to me.
Obviously, Corey's script was seen as a pillar of femininity at the time because it was that original screenplay which won this film its lone Oscar, though it was nominated for 5 others on the night. Best Film Editing, Best Cinematography, Best Director, and the 2 leading actress noms that we'll talk about.
Right.
129-minute runtime produced by Path. Percy Main Productions, Star Partners 3 Limited, and MGM, who also distributed the film. It had a $16.5 million budget, pulled in nearly 3 times that amount during its theatrical run, ending up with $45.4 million box office, which sounds all good, and yet the IMDb score is its lowest among its ratings. It stands at a 7.4 on IMDb on 114,000 plus reviews.
Makes sense. It makes sense why it's polarizing. I get it.
It is polarizing, but again, IMDb is its lowest rating. 84% certified fresh rating on Rotten Tomato, fairly high. 67 critics reviews, 56 of them positive. Average rating of 7.8 out of 10. The 7.4 on IMDb is also lower than its 82% audience score on 169,000 reviews with the average of 3.4 out of 5. And the IMDb score is well lower than its 88 Meta rating from Metacritic, which is even 3 points higher than Silence of the Lambs scored on Metacritic.
Oh, wow.
So, well,
so critics beloved. Beloved it?
Yeah, sure. And normal people hated it. No, I don't know.
No, normal people are polarizing. If you're not ready for it, you got to be ready for this movie.
We'll try to do this in steps. Mike's going to give us a biofilmography since I can't call them production profiles anymore. A jerk.
I'm stingy to terminology, Michael.
Just talk.
So my bio/filmography of Gina Davis. Here we go.
You.
Born in Wareham, Massachusetts. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. Gina Davis's mother worked as a teacher's assistant and her dad was a civil engineer. A musical child, Gina played the piano, flute, and was the organist for her church growing up, where her dad was also a deacon. Gina Davis went to New England College before moving to Boston University to get her bachelor's degree in drama. And like most bachelor's degrees in drama and the fine arts go, she didn't exactly get good work coming out of college there. She was a window mannequin at Ann Taylor before coming to life and inspiring a bad 80s movie, or being discovered as a model by the Zoli Modeling Agency. Oh, one of those two things are true, Michael.
I would have thought that you know, they have mannequins for that now. What a bad joke.
While working as a model, Davis was cast by Sydney Pollack as a soap opera actress in the movie Tootsie. Underrated movie. It's a pretty good movie. It actually stands up in terms of the screenwriting to this day. She's good in it. This led to a season of TV in Buffalo Bill, an ironic show title.
How about that?
Only to this podcast.
In
this particular podcast.
Kidnap girls and skin them.
Oh,
yes,
my God. She spent the next 3 years, Gina Davis, in TV, including a role in the movie Fletch.
Fletch.
But she was cast in her breakout role in 1986's, I think it was, The Fly by David Cronenberg. She would marry Jeff Goldblum after this happened.
Which is scarier, you think? The movie The Fly or being married to Jeff Goldblum?
Every day would be an adventure. That's all I would say. Jeff Goldblum.
Or you just get real, like, you give him eggs, and he's like, eggs find a way. Leave, Jeff.
I don't think Jeff's movie persona and his actual real life persona are all that different.
I don't either.
That would just be me. I don't know. I don't know this to be true, but I would be dying to ask, is he nice in real life? Is he like what he is?
Please
in
leave
movies?
Me alone.
All right. So anyway,
trying to sit and read.
Beetlejuice followed a year later, and her star was certainly on the rise.
Yeah, her and Molly Ringwald were kind of elbowing each other out for all those redheaded parts.
Earth Girls Are Easy and an Oscar-winning Best Supporting Actress role would follow in 1988 in The Accidental Tourist.
Mountaintop!
Yeah, 3 years later, she was cast as Thelma in our subject for today's review, Thelma and Louise. Like everyone else, my other favorite Gina Davis role came in A League of Their Own.
There's no crying in baseball!
As the catcher Dottie Henson. There's no crying in baseball! I love that movie.
Tom Hanks doesn't make bad films. He doesn't. I don't care what you say.
The John Lovitz character in that movie is pretty phenomenal. But her sister's character is one of my favorite all-timers. She's so good. The Long Kiss Goodnight. The epic flop, Cutthroat Island.
That is a historical flop. It actually shut down a production company, I think.
She was married to the director of it at the time, Renny Harlin. The Stuart Little.
Kind of killed her career as the leading lady, too.
It derailed it a little bit. The Stuart Little trilogy, a Golden Globe winning and SAG and Emmy nominated role in the TV series Commander in Chief, as well as stints on TV series The Exorcist and most recently Grey's Anatomy. Those are the other notable roles for Geena Davis over the last many years. I guess we could say she was in a terrible movie last year called Marjorie Prime. I'm not looking at you. Also, for the record, she almost...
You're a terrible movie.
That movie just made me bored.
Movie was
fine.
It was pretty good. It was probably innovative.
Whatever.
You're an idiot.
She almost qualified for the U.S. Olympic archery team in 1999, Michael.
Placing. What do you think those tryouts are like?
She placed 24th out of 300 participants.
So don't run away from Geena Davis.
Right.
She'll bow you down.
Bow you down. That's my Geena Davis biofilmography.
She does play Thelma in this role, and Thelma is kind of the repressed housewife to Shooter McGavin, of all people, who's a...
I also have Shooter McGavin written in my notes. Good job.
What's his name? Michael McDonald? Michael? No, it's Yamo B there. But it's Shooter McGavin.
It's anyway. Shooter McGavin.
He's a certainly vocally abusive husband, emotionally abusive husband.
That's
there's
one of
no
the first,
physical abuse.
Right. That's the introductory scene to her character, just kind of in the kitchen with her husband coming home late from work. I just love the toughness on her face, but she turns away from him to kind of grill him when she wants to ask a serious question. He gets his way, and it's kind of important for her arc that he does in those scenes. But I just love the grit that she shows underneath kind of the housewife bowing to her husband's will there. She does cower to his will. However, she shows that little edge, and I loved it.
We're going to try to keep the two nominees separate and give them their own proper due, but it's obviously tough to talk about one without the other. But the point I wanted to make is that the character arcs for both women is kind of like a yin and yang as they go from like wild child to reserved and reserved to wild child a little bit. And it's Thelma who's kind of riding the roller coaster of reserved to wild child.
But here's the thing. You need to give her that underlying edge and her serious face, the facial expression. Listen to my review of Solo, a Star Wars Story. You need to give
that's
them...
That's not a review. That's a man yelling in a microphone.
But you have to give them reason for the arc. You can't just spring, oh, she's going to become this.
Right. This is a very gritty story for the first act or the second act, whatever you want to
foreshadowing
define that as.
Is the vocabulary term I was looking for there, the word of the day.
So Geena Davis has this friend who is a diner waitress in Louise, played by Susan Sarandon, who checks in and wants Davis to go on this road trip with her to some guy's cottage, her ex-boss, boss's whatever.
Yes.
She's getting a divorce. Doesn't
girls
matter.
Trip.
Yeah, right. So it's a girls trip. And Geena Davis, being the reserved, fairly repressed wife that she is, keeps saying, I haven't asked my husband, I haven't asked my husband. And eventually she just finds it within her to leave with Susan Sarandon when Louise comes to pick her up. So Thelma and Louise are on this road trip and they're leaving without telling Shooter McGavin that she's going. But, oh, by the way, Thelma doesn't leave the house without making sure that she has literally Chekhov's gun on her.
Again, her that underlying edge.
Right, right. Eventually, this road trip leads them to this honky-tonk bar where they launch a bunch of line dancing. It sounds like my personal hell. But Thelma ends up getting close and smoozy with this guy throughout the night there. They end up spending a couple hours getting drunk at this bar. Something happens, which is
major
the big,
event.
Big twist, in the first twist anyway, in the movie that leads to actions being taken by the two women. And eventually they are pretty much on the run trying to make it to Mexico. Maybe it was Michael McDonald. Oh my God. Such a long way to go to make it to the border of Mexico.
Is that the song?
Yes. That's not Yamo B there, but that's such a long way to go.
Well, all right.
Parodied greatly by Brooke Miranda. It's an SCTV skit. Don't worry about it. Go ahead. What's your take? What are you talking about? What are we doing?
Events shape this character. And talk about Clarice Starling wrestling with her feelings.
Yes.
Geena Davis is going through PTSD while also trying to return to her old self throughout that act of the story, throughout that early second act. It's an amazing acting job because it's true to both things. And just to see how torn she is, to see how she's trying to just get beyond it, get past it, try to cope with it.
It's memorable too, because, and it's real to life, to build on what you're saying, because we know, or we've been that person that's got to act one way with their spouse or their loved one, whether it's unfortunately due to abuse or restrictions or any kind of that nonsense, but you're not allowed to be yourself. And as soon as she gets in that car, she's herself, and herself is this happy-go-lucky, optimistic, looking on the bright side type person.
How she moves around that motel and how she sits there listening to music as she sunbathes is some of her best acting in the entire movie.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree.
It's remarkable what she accomplishes in those kind of throwaway scenes that we often talk about. I'm so impressed with Gina Davis in this thing. I think this is perhaps one of her career highlights for sure.
I'm with you there. I was very surprised in general with this movie. I did not think it was going to be not only as enjoyable as it was, but as well done as it was.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a credit to the natural chemistry between the two women, their talents, and the direction given to them as well by Scott. I think that combination.
We've reviewed some Ridley Scott movies
before. It jumps off the screen.
Yeah, when he gets good scripts, he really can direct the shit
writing
out of
too.
It.
I meant to include that, obviously. That's
he can direct the shit out of it, and he has actors. He's a great actor's director, and he knows what to do visually. This movie is quite the road trip journey, let's just say that. I loved how it kind of went tension relief, how it kind of went to some fun stuff amidst all the action, all the harrowing stuff, and it's both suspenseful and it's funny. Those tonal shifts, when they work, movies that bend genre like this one did, this is kind of a trendsetter. Like, you think about what happens in this movie and then the tone of it throughout their girls' trip, which it still turns into. I'm thoroughly impressed with what they accomplished there.
And watching them, you're totally right, enjoy the girls' trip aspect of it, even though knowing at the forefront of their mind what they're going through and who they're running from and what happened, the acting is unbelievable by both women to pull off these types of characters. And like you just said, Gina Davis, Northeast, having to pull off a Southern accent, having to pull off that type of character as well, pretty seamless. Let's get into Gina Davis's or Thelma's best scenes here, and we'll talk about them for a minute. What'd you have? Lead us off.
I mentioned the first two, but I loved a scene later in the movie where she's made this transformation. It's hard to go without spoilers, but she's just overcome this huge screw up, right? And she walks into a convenience store, and then you have this great scene. And it's just her being as charming as she's been this entire movie, and yet pulling off some phenomenal subtext. I can't get over it. And it's, again, brilliant writing, because she was at her lowest of the low, and she learns from it on a dime and pulls this off.
Yeah, loved it. Highly intelligent woman. A highly intelligent character.
Highly intelligent screenwriter.
This screen.
How does she not have? Foundation for the greatest career?
Maybe people did have a problem because the feminist tones in this movement are so huge, and maybe people looked negatively on it for that reason.
If my sarcasm didn't come through, then I'm sorry, because it has to be. She should have had a rock star career.
If this movie is made today, there's a world in which it gets best picture consideration.
Weinsteins of the world hate it.
Yeah, exactly. But, you're totally right. I think that's it. And it's not right. But my best scene having to do with Thelma, as well as about her evolution, and it's not so much a scene as it just is her action. She's always, you start with this character that's pretty much so worried about like the fallouts of her action. She's very laissez-faire, and she's very optimistic, like I said. She tries to look on the bright side when she does screw up, but she tries not to screw up. And then by the end of it, by the time we get to this convenience store scene, or by the time we're at a part in the road trip where she needs to give a dialogue to Louise to kind of pick her up after Louise was the one doing the picking up at the first part of the movie, she's totally transformed into this different character. And that evolution is so hard to pull off if it's based in reality, and it's tough to believe if it's not done properly.
Right.
But again, the combination of the screenplay, the direction, and the talent of these women, I don't think that can be overstated enough.
One thing I really like about this movie, you have movie star good-looking people. This is a beautiful model, this human being. She's gorgeous, right? Gina Davis, back then, now, by today's standards, no she's question. Classically beautiful. And in many movies, you have that thoroughly good-looking person just kind of glossed over. She's just trying to act like a normal schmo.
You know, or they put the Nicole Kidman nose from The Others on her.
It is key to her character. And her character being fawned over by every man she comes across. Yep. And for Brad Pitt, the same way. I mean, these characters have gotten along on their looks, or at least they have gotten an edge on their situation by their looks. And she does that early on, and it's also obviously something that she has to pay a price for. Her relationship with Susan Sarandon's Louise, Gina's relationship with Louise, Thelma's relationship with Louise, if I can speak. It's built on this kind of sisterly thing where Louise takes care of Thelma, right? For most of the movie. It's remarkable how she becomes a good friend to Louise by the end of it.
It's a total yin and yang because they've kind of reversed positions as far as the caretaking and the quote unquote mother slash leader of the group of the two of them. And it gets without question Louise in the first part of the movie. And it's without question Thelma in the second part of the movie until a certain event happens.
I love that. I love that in terms of the writing, and Gina Davis sells that. And it's great.
What about worst scenes for Thelma? You got anything?
I don't love the trucker scene. This is going to be my worst scene for both characters. It is such an indulgence because you just want to stick it to the catcalling trucker. Again, I'm not going to get into the spoiler of it, but he's a catcaller. He's disgusting. And his performance is so bad. It's so over the top.
His performance is terrible.
It's terrible. It's like a cartoon. It's absurd. And of course he needs to get it. You know, he needs to get his comeuppance. And these girls are very, you know, reminded me of Kill Bill.
It's a good analogy.
Yeah. She's kind of given a lot of sass, right, in that scene, which is great. But for them to risk what they risk just to stick it to this guy is just nonsense.
So here's my take, and this is verbatim what I wrote down in my notes about that scene. I know this is insane and unrealistic, but my God, how relevant is this to the anti-catcalling or trying to shame these disgusting jackasses that won't let women just walk down the street today, won't let them live in peace? I love it.
It's a mission statement type scene.
It is. You're totally right, and it's a bit out of place.
For someone like me who's never been catcalled in my life, I could criticize it.
I guess.
I'm criticizing myself because as an ignorant human being, I could do I do this. But and it doesn't work in the movie, and I can, you know, kind of step outside of it.
You do what?
I'm not a good-looking man, but I'm not catcalled. So right. I don't understand. Like, this should feel satisfying for a lot of beautiful women, a lot of people who have been catcalled. Yeah. And regardless of if it fits in the plot or not,
I agree.
It's worthwhile, correct?
Yeah.
But as a asshole, I criticize it, even though I'm valid in my criticism. That's
just
what I'm trying to say.
Just say you're wrong.
I'm wrong, but I'm right.
Fine. I'll take that half.
I'm so long-winded.
My worst scene is how some of these scenes are so goddamn appropriate to what's going on in modern day society, and some of the problems we're still fucking encountering with women and in terms
of
strong
women. So your
worst
scene is reality.
Yeah, it is. Because this movie was made in 1991.
God.
It's 27 years later, and we're still dealing with, well, we can't go to the cops because they won't believe us. We're still dealing with the catcallers. We're still dealing with all these terrible men that beat up women in their homes emotionally or verbally because they think they deserve it and they think they're the king. I hate it. Things should have changed. I know that's me on my high horse. I don't mean to get on the soapbox, but this movie was amazing to me in how relevant and current it still is.
And how it dramatizes those things. Again, we're not going into spoilers, but this is, again, not Battle of the Sexes, Stronger Together speech. You don't get speeches throughout this movie.
No, no.
You get drama.
You're not beat over the head with it, but you get
cinema.
Very obvious as well.
You get thespianism.
What do we have for the Louise character of Susan Sarandon?
Okay, Susan Sarandon, biofilmography. Thank you. Born in Queens, New York, Sarandon is the eldest of nine children.
How about that household?
which I feel good about because she kind of validates my need for attention as well, as I'm the oldest of five children.
You and her family.
So Susan and me are basically the same person.
Right. That's what I was going to say.
Basically the same. Anyway, Susan's dad was an advertising executive and former nightclub singer. She was raised Roman Catholic and grew up in Edison, New Jersey. She then went to Catholic University, majoring in drama. However, as huge of a talent as she was, I mean, she would tell you she got some lucky breaks early on, but only a year after her graduation, Sarandon was cast. Unlike her husband, who went for roles in this movie, Chris Sarandon, she was cast in the motion picture Joe. She acted in soap operas for the next 3 years, but basically got steady work right after graduation. A couple years after that, she cast in a breakthrough performance in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. The rest of the 70s nabbed her four major movie roles, including Atlantic City, where she was nominated for her first Oscar for lead actress. Susan Sarandon played a lesbian vampire opposite Catherine Deneuve in The Hunger of 1983, which caused some controversy back in that dystopic nightmare that was the early 80s. All those misbegotten children of the Dead Poets Society men from the end of the 1950s in that quagmire of family values.
It's a role that every actress has to play on the way up the ladder, the lesbian vampire. We've all been there.
But yeah, the 80s people had a problem with it. Anyway, Sarandon starred opposite Jack Nicholson, Cher, and Michelle Pfeiffer, a movie that just keeps coming up in our travels through these retrospectives, by the way. The Witches of Eastwick.
Yeah, we can't get away from it.
We thought it was Moonlight. It's not Moonstruck. Which we then confused
called
with Moonlight.
Yes. Yes, very good.
In 1988, Susan Sarandon had her A-list breakout role in Bull Durham, Kevin Costner baseball movie with Tim Robbins as well. She gets married to Tim Robbins. Perhaps my favorite baseball movie of all time, by the way. I would be very curious to kind of weigh. I love it because it's a big screenwriting movie. Screenwriting
Bull Durham,
guru
but hate
movie.
Field of Dreams. That makes no sense.
I know. I really love Bull Durham. We'll have to do a baseball movie pod at some point,
I
think.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether our audience is going to listen to it. We don't care! Go back and listen to our basketball movies
Just stop selling
them. Somebody
please
listen to it. At least all the Knicks and Celtic fans
Nobody wants them.
Listen, we get very into our fanhood and parts of it, which might turn it off. I wonder if we should do an edited version. A director's cut.
No, we should never do another one of those.
Because, listen, yeah, we get it. We do a little deep dive into our New York and Boston.
Please keep talking about Susan Sarandon.
All right. Sarandon's 1990s featured bona fide starring roles as a lead actress. Lorenzo's Oil, The Client, and Dead Man Walking nabbed her three more Oscar nominations.
She's awesome.
Thelma and Louise, her fourth in 91-92. She won for her role in Dead Man Walking, and rightfully so. Yes, Michael, I did watch that movie in my middle school English class.
I went to the wrong school system.
The Player, Little Women, Stepmom, and Cradle Will Rock are also other notable 1990s films for student Susan Sarandon, so quite the decade for her there.
One of them is also a Van Halen song. That means nothing.
Did Stepmom make you cry there, Michael?
Did Stepmom make me cry? I don't believe I've seen Stepmom.
Well, I mean, of course not. It didn't make me cry either. Okay, her 2000s, Susan Sarandon included a guest spot on this little-known TV show called Friends.
Not familiar.
As well as Malcolm in the Middle. Great performances in smaller movies like the Golden Globe-nominated Igby Goes Down. Great performance by her. That movie has its ups and downs to it. Moonlight Mile, In the Valley of Evil, Elah, and Solitary Man. In the Valley of Elah comes up a lot, too. Solitary Man with Michael Douglas there, I think. I think that was Michael Douglas. Anyway, her big movies of the 2000s showcased her, Susan Sarandon, in more supporting roles, including Enchanted, Shall We Dance with Richard Gere, and The Banger Sisters, I think was with Goldie Hawn.
I believe so.
And unfortunately, Mr. Woodcock with Billy Bob Thornton. Mm. The last decade has featured Sarandon in a variety of roles, very versatile, from Wall Street Money Never Sleeps as like a mentor character to Robot and Frank, which is a weird Frank Langella movie, to 30 Rock cameos, to schlock comedies where she is legitimately funny, and That's My Boy and Tammy with Melissa McCarthy there.
That's My Boy might be Adam Sandler's most underrated movie.
It makes us laugh, doesn't it?
It's really fun.
And Susan Sarandon is freaking She kills me in Tammy as the drunk mom of Melissa McCarthy. That movie's not good, but she is good in it.
You're right.
Anyway, Emmy nominated role after all that. She's been in this multi-nominee feud, Betty and Joan, where she plays Betty Davis.
Did you watch any of that?
I still haven't watched it.
I haven't either. We have to. How have we not watched it?
I know. You know, we should almost do a full...
Too much to... I mean, we're watching everything right now.
That's true. She's also been an ongoing character in Showtime's Ray Donovan, which my dad loves and pronounces Donovan. You like my, you know, my punching up of my copy here?
He's getting more insight into the Also Mike family.
To wrap it up, Susan Sarandon has been nominated for 9 Golden Globes, including the previously unmentioned by me, Bernard and Doris, and White Palace. Nominated in total for 5 Emmys, including what I neglected to mention, her role in You Don't Know Jack, the HBO original movie with Al Pacino. She's also won a BAFTA for The Client and a Caring Women in Motion Award at the 2016 Cannes Film Festival. Many other career achievement awards along the way in the last 3 years. But Cannes Film Festival, something we just recently talked about in our last Hollywood Hot Takes.
You can tell when you're dealing with one of the greats in cinema history when you're...
Accolades.
When your movie, your... What do you call them? What are these called?
My filmography. You're right. I can't mention her whole filmography have a coherent through line to it.
Right. You can always tell you're doing great when the filmography takes forever. Because like Jodie Foster's, Susan Sarandon's as well. Gina Davis had a long one as well.
Where's Thomas Shulman when you need him to give us some different kind of, you know, shtick? But I couldn't write it this. I just kind of a gush. Filmography after another.
Sarandon plays the diner waitress Louise, who's kind of the more... Type A one of the two, Thelma and Louise, to start off. She's the one that wants to, that's cajoling Thelma to join her on this road trip to this cabin that her boss is getting divorced and leaving behind for her friends or whatever, blah, blah, blah. So she forces Thelma to take the jump and come in with her. And she's the one driving that takes Thelma to the bar at the beginning where the big scene happens. In that big scene, you're the one that always talks about facial expressions and acting and all that. Did Susan Sarandon get nominated based on her eyes in that big scene?
Her eyes are terrified.
They are,
and her hand is steady. I loved it.
So good. So good. One of my best scenes, without question. She's involved in that big moment. She has actually the more intricate part to the big moment. The fallout happens, and then again, that yin-yang relationship, the tide starts to turn. Sarandon goes from this big type A leader of the group making decisions to kind of needing to be picked up at some point. She's down in her dumps, and another twist happens that leaves her devastated, that leads to the general store scene with Thelma taking lead, as we talked about previously. So that's kind of the transformation of her character, but to... both Ridley Scott's credit and to Callie Corey's credit, it's not as if she loses her drive and motivation. She's still a very capable character, even when she's down in the dumps, which is very important.
And yet showing her vulnerability throughout. In one of the more interesting internal struggles shown, that, you know, impossibly through this acting performance. I can't get over, and yes, she has showcase scenes, but Susan Sarandon is one of the few. She's like, she feels like a powder keg.
Oh yeah.
And it looks like she's going to go off at any moment, but she always kind of leaves you wanting more, in a sense that she doesn't do that, you know, ham Oscar nabbing kind of a scene, right?
No.
That begging scene, give me the Oscar.
Right. No, it's just a badass performance.
Yeah, she's always really reserved, and she gives scenes what they need and not too much more than that. And I think the scenes with Michael Madsen, her boyfriend.
A svelte Michael Madsen, by the way. The guy looks like a fucking model in this movie.
I love what he brought to this thing because he is menacing, right? Just his persona in the Tarantino movies. And he's menacing in this movie at the same time. it's drawing out this performance in Susan Sarandon, or maybe she's drawing it out in him, where she's both walking on eggshells and standing her ground and being firm with what she knows she has to do for her and for Gina Davis's character. I'm just in awe of how this played out.
You sound like you're higher in terms of re-ranking, which we'll do in the second part of this category. You sound like you're
really
higher
tough.
With Sarandon. I think
really
I might be
tough.
Higher with Sarandon personally myself as
I
well.
I'll tell you what. I think these three performances, they can win in any year.
I totally agree.
And it's rare that
totally
that happens.
Totally agree. I was not expecting that from Thelma and Louise.
No,
honestly,
not at all.
I wasn't. And I certainly wasn't expecting
that. I had never seen this movie before this
me
year.
Either, me either. I certainly wasn't expecting the feminist statements. It's funny that Louise kind of takes on the role of the jokester, too, at the end. She makes a joke about how you can't justify robbery and then admits to having stolen something in the next breath, which made me legitimately laugh out loud. She has some good one-liners. She has some good quips. She's also a very complex character, as pretty much every character in this movie is. I mean, even Harvey Keitel's policeman character is one that's kind of rooting for the women at some point.
There, so many little touches in this movie sell it and sell these characters as real people.
No doubt this was worthy of a Best Original Screenplay win.
Absolutely. I think, again, to mention that Louise, Susan Sarandon, is like the caretaker for Gina Davis while Gina Davis is wigging out.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, it's kind of a role reversal to watch the versatility for both of these actresses and pulling that off.
It's awesome.
And kind of trading, you know, the type A and type B roles, the alpha beta stuff. Versatility, Mike, it's a word that I'm overusing, but it's so true here.
We just gushed about how great Gina Davis was, and I'm saying that I think Sarandon might have brought even more to the table. And it's kind of, I would not think in a billion years that Thelma and Louise would be the movie I'm saying that if you're a screenwriter or want to be director, or certainly a lead, aspirations of being an actor or an actress,
right.
You study this.
There's a lot to learn.
There's so much in this movie.
And these performances especially.
Yeah. Also,
big fan.
Is Brad Pitt the best looking man of all time?
I didn't look away. I didn't look down. I didn't stutter.
I'm a straight man, but I'm drooling. My God.
But they don't ignore that fact. He's not just regular schmo
Jim.
No, he's
Jim. There. I mean,
it's written into the fabric of his character, that him being a great looking guy. And same with Gina Davis, and same with Susan Sarandon, for that matter.
Let's do best scene, worst scene quick with the Louise character, Susan Sarandon.
I had the showdown early. I also think her reactions to Gina Davis's big coming out party as a serious,
it's really cool, yeah, very genuine.
Later on in the movie, just her reactions are amazing to me. Talk about acting, reacting. It's very their performances are giving, but in the way she does go for it in her reactions at the end,
yeah.
And I loved it.
Yeah, she's the one that actually comments. Even police excess is brought up in this movie,
right.
So ahead of its time.
Timely.
She's the one that makes a comment about something happens where, and she can't believe the number of police that are being used to address the subject. The scene with the eyes that we talked about. There's so much good stuff in this movie.
But and she can really give it to Gina Davis for Gina Davis's screw ups, for Thelma's screw ups, and she doesn't do that, which gives you a lot of respect for her character. Obviously, the performance is there to back it up, but especially when Gina Davis is going through her arc and screwing the hell up. I just love that wrestling match she's having with herself in those scenes, because she's freaking out. Her world is crumbling and her friend is in many ways the cause of it, but there's just empathy there.
Yeah.
There's sympathy there. This is my best friend and I got to be here for her and I got to hold my shit together for her.
Her home life is worse than what she's going through right now. She can't go back home. She can't go to prison. Yeah.
And yeah, the arc of the movie is that Gina Davis comes through for her at the mm-hmm. very end of it. So that works. It's a great friend. It's a great friend movie. I wouldn't say it's a great driving movie, but it's a great movie about friendship.
Just another example of how this movie was ahead of its time. Nothing to do with either performance, but the black guy on the bicycle when he comes across a cop car in this movie.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Laughed hysterically.
It's funny.
And also so relevant to today and so proper for what's been going on. But watch the movie. You'll see all that.
Good movie.
Let's do worst scene. I know you already said. My worst scene has to do with the very, very end. And if you know how Thelma and Louise ends, you'll know what I'm talking about. If you don't, I'll dance around it. But the way in which Louise just agrees to Thelma's idea at the end with no pushback.
Yeah, but I think that's the whole point. I thought they built up to it. I was surprised because I was figuring on that same objection, even though I knew we were going non-spoilers. I would argue with it.
She doesn't give it a second thought.
We can't have the argument.
No, we can't.
But the fact that Susan Sarandon's character in many scenes is considering this as a possibility, and the fact that Gina Davis is agreeing with her in the subtext, it did work for me because they do have a several scene buildup.
I don't disagree, but also it's a big decision.
I know. It is a big decision.
I'll just leave it there. So that's it. Those are the first two movies, first three performances for the 1991-92 Best Lead Actress category. Obviously, guys, this is a big, big category. This was the good of it. And the second half, part two, is going to come, and we're going to talk about the not-so-good of it.
It's going to be fun to heckle these next two movies, even though we like the performances.
Yes,
it's just
without
weird.
Question. And the actresses, even more so. But if you have anything on this part one, anything on Thelma and Louise, anything on The Silence of the Lambs, Hannibal Lecter, Clarice Starling, let us know. Get at us. Respond. Reach out to us. We're going to respond back. Mike just did. As you heard previously, we released our first ever The Devil and the Advocate short quarter-sode, quick-a-sode series where also Mike went on a rampage based in part responding to people on Twitter that got to us.
Yeah, that was fun. It was fun. We had a civil argument. It was the debate. It was
yes,
fun.
It's every, all
the
in
gifts
fun.
Got
nothing,
little...
Nothing, yeah.
The gifts were the strongest statements made, and which was funny. But
I believe it's pronounced GIF.
GIF. But yeah, Laura Dern. We have a long history with Laura Dern.
And our first Bette Midler.
As movie watchers. Yeah.
Our first
Bette I don't
Midler.
Have a lot of Bette Midler background in my life.
I don't either. Yeah.
I really don't. And I was fascinated by her performance and her persona. She's larger than life, even though this movie kind of doesn't live up to her.
All stuff to get to in part two coming up later this week. Until then, reach out to us. Let us know. Mike and Oscar on Facebook, Mike and Oscar on Instagram, MM and Oscar on Twitter, MikeMikeandOscar.com, MikeMikeandOscar@gmail.com, MikeMikeandOscar@reddit.com.
The last thing I'd say is maybe watch some clips of these next two movies that we are not going to recommend. Ramblin'
Rose.
To save
you from having to ever
see
them.
For the boys. But just so, yeah, you get some context. I think that might be fun because I think there's some good YouTube clips out there. We will definitely
Rage
give
up.
You links to those. I also want to say, I guess, one more thing. One of the things I definitely want to do eventually, even though Mike guarded me against this, I'm going to say it anyway. I get it. I don't want to promise
too
much.
We're great at keeping promises around here.
That's it. You've made most of the promises we haven't kept, by the way, for the record.
Get to the point, sir.
I'm going to write some scene analyses on our website. It's going to be one of the kind of articles we do at some point. And I want to just, you know, to reference you on this pod for Silence of the Lambs and Thelma and Louise, I'm probably going to note some scenes from those movies. So if you didn't get your spoiler-filled fix, I'll have that on the website at some point in the next 10 to 50 years.
Yeah, think of it as us going to jail and we committed the crimes Hannibal did. And after that, you'll get a website.
You'll eventually get some written content about Silence of the Lambs and Thelma and Louise from Mike and Oscar in the next century.
Reality sucks, guys. Keep watching movies with us. Come back and hang out with us in a couple days for part two of the 91-92 Best Lead Actress category.
See ya.